Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. 13 dead, 4 missing. That's the way the figures look this morning after the worst tragedy in yachting history. It occurred in a raging storm off southwest England during the race from the Isle of Wight off southern England to Fastnet Rock at the southern tip of Ireland and back to Plymouth. Larry Miller reports from London.
At its worst, the winds were at gale force velocity, and the swells rose 40 feet into the air. The smaller yachts in the Admiral's Cup race off the southwest coast of England were at the mercy of the weather conditions. At least 10 yachts sank in the rough seas. Among them was the Ariadne, a 24-foot United States-registered craft. 5 of its crew members are among the dead. At least one is known to have been an American. When darkness fell last night, the massive air and sea rescue operation had to be cut back. But with the start of the new day, it got underway again. And according to the man heading the operation from Cornwall, England, Commander William Barry, it'll probably continue at least through the next day or so. Barry reports helicopters and airplanes are now out searching the seas.
They'll be looking for the yachts and marking them, and we're just as interested now, obviously, in who's well, so we account for who's missing.
But with an improvement in the weather, many of the yachts have decided to continue racing.
The conditions are much better, thank God, today. The wind has died away, and it's about 10 to 15 knots. Maximum 20 knots in the area.
A substantial number of the yachts are still unaccounted for, but that doesn't mean they're in trouble. A Navy spokesman explained they could have gone out to deeper waters until conditions improved. Larry Miller for CBS News, London.
In the western Pacific, a typhoon is gaining strength as it moves north off the southern Japanese island of Okinawa. At least 4 people are reported missing in heavy seas. The storm's highest winds are clocked at 90 miles an hour. UN Ambassador Andrew Young today is in hot water with both Israel and the White House. That's because of a meeting he held last month with an official of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Young at first said the meeting occurred by chance and nothing substantive was discussed. But yesterday, the State Department had to revise its original account of the episode, saying that Young and the PLO man discussed the question of putting off a Security Council vote on the Palestinian issue. Bernard Kalb now analyzes the effect of the affair on the White House.
The latest Young incident presents a variety of awkward challenges to President Carter, and not at a good time. Domestically, it looks as though the president, who already has enough problems, is not getting the full and accurate story of what's going on from a senior cabinet official. In terms of foreign policy, the Young move complicates Mr. Carter's relations with both the Arabs and the Israelis. By rebuking Young for his unauthorized meeting with a PLO representative, the White House has underscored its differences with the Arabs on a major aspect of policy on dealing with the PLO. This at a time when the U.S. is trying to woo the Palestinians into joining Israeli-Egyptians' autonomy talks. As for the Israelis, they already suspect the U.S. is tilting toward the Arabs on this issue because of the need for Arab oil. The Young PLO contact will only confirm that suspicion, even if the Israelis believe that the Young action represented personal rather than official U.S. diplomacy. Bernard Kalb, CBS News, Washington.
The Jerusalem Post this morning says the U.S. ambassador to Austria, Milton Wolf, had a long and detailed meeting in Vienna last month with another senior PLO official. The newspaper doesn't say exactly what they talked about, but it does say the meeting was unauthorized, like the one held by Young. A raid was conducted this morning in Northern Ireland. It's reported now by Mike Lee.
Police and army troops staged a pre-dawn raid in the Catholic sector of Belfast this morning and arrested 16 people on suspicion of terrorism. The raid is widely seen here as a response to Protestant anger over the fact that several masked gunmen appeared at a pro-IRA rally several days ago and were not arrested. A police spokesman this morning says that the public can rest assured that all such matters are being vigorously investigated, but implied there were special reasons for not arresting the masked gunmen when they first appeared in public. That reason being the risk of bloodshed involving innocent spectators at the rally. In several Northern Ireland cities last night, street rioting, the burning of hijacked cars, rock throwing, and scattered vandalism. In one town, Protestant youths, reacting to several days of Catholic unrest, went on a rampage and stoned policemen. The situation in Belfast this morning is calm, with an ever-present army helicopter circling the Catholic neighborhoods, and the army standing by should IRA supporters continue their protest of the 10th anniversary of British troops in Northern Ireland. Mike Lee, CBS News, Belfast.
The biracial government of Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, this morning announced its decision on participation in the new British Commonwealth Peace Initiative. Robin Wright reports from Salisbury.
A brief statement said the Muzorewa government will attend the first round of peace talks, scheduled to begin in London on September 10th. The British hope to find terms that will end the seven-year-old guerrilla war and lead to international recognition for the troubled territory. The other party involved in the peace effort, the Patriotic Front guerrilla movement, has not yet responded to the British invitation. But it is expected that pressure from black African countries will force the guerrillas to take part. There is now greater optimism in Salisbury over this peace initiative than there was during any previous attempt. Government insiders believe agreement can be reached over two controversial points: a new general election and constitutional changes affecting special rights and representation for whites. Robin Wright, CBS News, Salisbury.
There is increasing concern in the upper Middle West today over the continuing grain handlers' walkout. We'll hear about it from Rich Holter of CBS radio affiliate WCCO in Minneapolis.
The strike by 520 grain handlers in the ports of Duluth and Superior is now in its seventh week. And with the grain harvest underway in the Dakotas and Minnesota, pressure is mounting for some type of federal intervention to get grain shipments moving again. Minnesota Senator Dave Durenberger says he's getting sick and tired of the Labor Department telling him it's a local and not a national problem.
What I know is going to happen is if the union is going to stick to their demand for a cost of living clause in all these contracts, they aren't only picking on Duluth. They'll pick on St. Paul and New Orleans and Chicago and Milwaukee and Buffalo, New York and Cleveland, Ohio. And that is a national problem, even though they disagree with me on Duluth being a national problem.
Negotiations with one of eight struck grain companies will resume in Duluth later this week. But with no sign of a settlement, Durenberger and others want a Taft-Hartley injunction to force grain handlers back to work. Rich Holter for CBS News, Minneapolis.
2,300 firefighters are still at work today in central Idaho trying to bring the Mortar Creek forest fire under control. Along the South Texas coast, blobs of oil are showing up with increasing frequency on Gulf beaches, and authorities are afraid that a lot more pollution will occur in the next 3 weeks. This is the 34th anniversary of the virtual end of World War II. It was on this date in August 1945 that Emperor Hirohito announced Japan's acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration. For divided Korea, it's the 34th anniversary of Korean liberation from Japan's colonial rule. Bruce Dunning reports from Tokyo that North Korea has resumed its bitter verbal attacks on the United States after several months of unusually cordial approaches.
The blistering rhetoric has gotten tougher and more frequent since President Carter's visit to South Korea 6 weeks ago. Last spring, the North Koreans welcomed an American table tennis team to their country in hopes of a replay of the ping-pong diplomacy that originally brought the United States and China together. The North Koreans tried hard to impress visiting Americans with their desire to improve relations with the United States. They now seem to regard Mr. Carter's visit to South Korea as a flat rejection of their overtures, so they have returned to their stinging media attacks. Now, North Korean news agencies are denouncing Mr. Carter as a war maniac and an imperialist aggressor determined to hold on to South Korea as an American colony. The North Korean news agency reported recently what it called murderous American generals increasing their visits to South Korea, preparing a new war against the North. Now that the president has frozen his troop withdrawal plan from South Korea, the North Koreans accuse him, quote, of outstripping his predecessors in craftiness and bellicosity. Bruce Dunning, CBS News, Tokyo.
The dollar was virtually unchanged in Tokyo today and declined slightly in Europe, where several exchanges are closed for the holiday. Gold again rose to $300 an ounce in London and Zurich. United Press International quotes sources in Moscow as saying that a Soviet plane carrying a soccer team collided in the air with a second plane during the weekend, killing as many as 150 people. India's Prime Minister Charan Singh this morning charged that neighboring Pakistan is trying to produce an atomic bomb. And if Pakistan succeeds, he said, India may start turning on nuclear weapons itself. That's a situation that deeply troubles the United States.